Good morning, and welcome into this Wednesday edition of The Daily Perspective. Hi there, Mark Congleton here with you, hoping you are having a happening day today. As you can tell, we started a few seconds early, but hey, what you gonna do? I have fat fingers. I was trying to move forward in the process when the pre-show music was fading out, and a couple of these songs just fade forever, and I thought, you know what, let's just start the next song, and I clicked the wrong thing. So there we have it. I'm human. I'm fallible. I have fat fingers. I make mistakes. Hi, how are you? Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host for this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity. And we've already been absurd. It is a Wednesday edition of the program. We're out live on Facebook Live this morning, this 29th of May at 9 o'clock, 8 a.m. Central. And hello to those of you already queued up on Facebook Live. Good to have you along. And to those of you listening by means of podcast later on, thanks a lot for subscribing. I appreciate you being there. It means a lot to me, and I thank you for your loyalty and the fact that you're sharing this with other people. Thanks a lot. Good to have you here. It is a midweek edition of the show, and I was sitting here distracted, skimming through Twitter, looking at things that are going on right now on Twitter, because usually there's a little something that gets my attention, and Twitter is replete with wonderfulness some days, you know, it just is. And other days it's like, wow, I'm digging. Okay, I've seen it already. It's already happened. This is happening. So what? And one of the things that's popped up on Twitter, this is one of the things that, that I already had in the stack, is a photograph of Joe Biden at a meeting. He's at some place. He was speaking to people, and he's standing there in front of news cameras with his hands on the shoulders of a little girl. And remember what I said when Biden announced his candidacy. Remember, I said there would be people on his staff, on the campaign staff, whose jobs it would be to, one, keep him on script, to keep him from ad-libbing. Because when Joe starts ad-libbing, Joe gets in trouble. That's why the Obama administration pretty much kept him under wraps, kept him hidden, didn't let him speak, didn't let him do public appearances for 8 solid years. Because when Joe starts speaking off the script, when he ad-libs, there are people backstage with their faces in their hands going, oh, great, another thing we got to recover from. There are people on the campaign staff whose job it is to keep Joe on script. There is also at least one person, and probably they've gone through a couple by now, whose job it is to make sure Joe keeps his hands off of people unless he's shaking hands with people. The only human contact he should have on the campaign trail is shaking people's hands. Oops! Somebody let Joe off the leash, because there's been an interaction between creepy Uncle Joe and a 10-year-old girl that has stirred some ire on social media. He touched this young girl at a campaign rally. Despite pledging last month to be much more mindful about not invading people's personal space without their permission. This little girl, she asked him a question about political division in the country. She told him her favorite subject was journalism. So, Joe proceeded to bring her to the back of the room where the journalists and TV cameras were, and he put his hands on her shoulders. The moment raised some eyebrows among online commentators. You think? In the weeks leading up to his entrance into the race, a number of women said Mr. Biden had made them uncomfortable by touching them, leading to a reckoning around the physical way he has often interacted with women in public. And I think if you're like me, the image that keeps coming to your mind is Jeff Sessions moving his daughter away from Joe Biden at that public appearance. Remember that? Washington Post national political reporter Felicia Sumnes, pardon me, Felicia, I know you probably listen, also documented the incident, tweeting, quote, "In a somewhat odd moment at tonight's AFT town hall, Biden tells a 10-year-old girl, 'I'll bet you're as bright as you are good looking.' He takes her over to the assembled reporters, then stands behind her and puts his hands on her shoulders while she's talking. Recall that Biden filmed a video last month in which he vowed to respect women's personal space," she adds. "Seems he hasn't quite gotten the message." She also notes that Biden's campaign refused to respond to her request for comment about the incident. Biden received widespread condemnation on social media from conservatives and leftists for his behavior. For example, Sean King, this guy who can't quite make up his mind who he really is, he's a far-left activist. He said, and I quote, "What the hell? Please escort this man out of politics. He doesn't get it. This is so damn creepy. This may be a tipping point, honestly." Gee, you think, Sean? No, it won't. They'll stand behind this guy until he and Anthony Weiner are caught together doing something. Rosie O'Donnell. She tweeted, just hashtag creepy. Rosie. Leftist Elad Nehoria tweeted, "How the freaking freak is this guy leading against Warren?" Jim Hansen tweeted, "This isn't odd for him. He does it all the time. It's a sickness." Nick Searcy tweeted, "But he's the best Democrat running," or something. "Those girls need to be ignored and silenced in order to save women," or something. OMG, Russia, Putin, Trump. And what I think is possibly, no, this is not the best one, but it's one of them. Mark Krikorian, he tweeted, ... "Afterwards, he invited her into his van to see a puppy." Ooh. And the one I think is the best is from Stephen Miller, who tweets, "And that's when AIDS fired the tranquilizer dart." Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh. And the tranquilizer dart thing just owns me, because I can visualize people standing off in the wings with their faces in their hands going, "Oh, God, he did it. He finally did it. We've talked and talked and talked. We've had meetings. He said, yes, sure, yes, sure. He said he understood. He said he was going to be okay. We trusted him. We trusted him. He promised." And then afterwards, drinks were served, and there were a lot of people with hangovers the next day. Yikes. Oh, man. There's more. And if you'll get the show notes today, you can see the rest of the tweets. It's on the Daily Wire if you want to go look it up for yourself. It's just priceless. Joe Biden is Joe Biden, and we call him Creepy Uncle Joe for a reason. And let's go back to what I said a moment ago about the reasons that the Obama administration kept Joe under lock and key for 8 years. You very rarely saw Joe Biden out in public, because when you did see Joe Biden in public, he was ad-libbing and being an idiot, or he was leaning over and whispering very closely into women's ears, making people uncomfortable. He was touching little children, making people uncomfortable. Creepy Uncle Joe earned the nickname. He earned the nickname. Now, this photo that's on Twitter, by the way, Carpe Donctum is the guy who posted the Twitter photo. And hats off to him. His comment is, "Sadly, this is not doctored." In the photo, one of the things that jumped to my attention, once I had already processed this information about Joe and touching people, is this little girl. She's so smart. She's so smart. She's as smart as she is good looking. This little girl is holding a scripted question. Whoops. She's holding a scripted question. So, the handlers at this event made the decision to put this child on display for the press, asking a question which they put in her hands to ask. She's 10 years old. She's 10 years old. And supposedly, her favorite subject is journalism. Journalism. She's 10. And her favorite subject is journalism. How many 10-year-olds do you know who think journalism is just cool? I would say none. So, Joe's handlers have staged something for the press. And Joe kicks into creepy gear. God love him. And the story is everywhere now. It makes me wonder. As the commenters said, they need to get rid of this guy, move forward. I don't think he's going anywhere. I think until they catch him like they caught Anthony Weiner, I don't think anything will change. I just don't. When you look at the field of contestants so far. I'm sorry. I'm looking for ways to describe the Democrat presidential contest here. And there's no way. I mean, the only thing I can come up with is creepy clown music. Because here we are. We have all the clowns in the clown car. And then there's Uncle Joe out front. He's the leading candidate. And he's the head clown. He's the one with the biggest feet and the biggest nose and the best makeup. And he has a thing for chainsaws and small children, and I think there's something really disturbing about that. It's just wrong. Ah! It's creepy Uncle Joe! Look out, kids. Don't touch that balloon. Oh, good gravy. This is where we are with the Democrats today. It's just sad and freaky, and it's laughable, and it's sad, and it's infuriating, and it's just bizarre. And this is who and what they are. And the people who are willing to invest so much time and belief in them, it amazes me. It just amazes me. But I guess I shouldn't be amazed, because they're willing to believe practically anything. Practically anything. And here's an example. A foreign affairs columnist, editor for Time Magazine, a guy named Ian Bremmer, over the weekend, on Sunday, he thought it'd be clever to tweet out an outrageous and completely fake quote from President Trump praising North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, just to see what happens. The quote spread like wildfire on Twitter, and Bremmer achieved his goal of duping a lot of people on both sides of the aisle before he was called out and deleted the tweets. Now, why would he have duped these people? Why? Because they wanted to believe him. There's that old principle about con men. Con men, generally speaking, aren't conning honest people. They're conning someone who wants a con themselves. The fake quote was inspired by a real tweet from President Trump that praised Kim Jong-un as reliable and touting him and calling him former Vice President Joe Biden low IQ. Sunday morning, Bremmer tried to come to one-up Trump, and he sent out a tweet that read, "President Trump in Tokyo, Kim Jong-un is smarter and would make a better president than sleepy Joe Biden." Now, the quote is completely fake. It racked up over 1,000 retweets from left-wing journalists like Anna Navarro from CNN. Ted Lieu, the Democrat from California, he promoted the quote to an even larger audience. The both of them did. So when they retweeted, retweeted to thousands upon thousands more people who then retweet it again. Because they all wanted to believe it was real. Oh, this is perfect. This is perfect. Well, a few hours later, he got called out by a user on Twitter who was skeptical about the authenticity. And he's deleted a bunch of tweets, but he did justify the quote as plausible, and he added it was a comment on the state of media and the Twitterverse today. In a way, yes. Because media and people on social media, the news media and people on social media, want to believe certain things. Their bias leads them to believe certain things. They want to believe that President Trump would say something like that on Twitter. Even though, as active as he is on Twitter, I don't think he would say something like that on Twitter. They're so invested in the lie, they're willing to believe anything.
And while I'm on the subject of public nuisances...
Wait, what does he mean by that? Welcome back to The Daily Perspective. Hi there, Mark Congleton here, driving the crazy train down the tracks that is a Wednesday. I hope you're having a good one. I posted something to social media just before we got started this morning. It's a link to an article on the Washington Times, WashingtonTimes.com, about the Illinois House approving a late-term abortion bill. And the little teaser headline thing that the Washington Times put up was, "The Illinois House approves late-term bill creating fundamental right to abortion." And what hit me was, well, that's typical. That is the typical leftist mindset. Leftists believe rights are granted, created by government. But you and I, rational, honest people who see things as they really are, understand that rights are granted by our Creator. And our founders said so, that we are granted by our Creator certain fundamental rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is our Creator that grants rights. Government has a role to play in the rights process by protecting the rights granted to us by our Creator. When we acknowledge that we have a Creator and that our rights come from that Creator, then we can't honestly look at abortion rights and say they come from Him. Because no one in their right mind, no honest, rational individual is going to claim that God wants women to destroy their unborn children. And if they do insist that, you need to put as much distance between you and them as humanly possible. We'll have more on that coming up. First, a little bit more from the absurdity department. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's a Democrat from New York. She's going to be bartending again. Now, don't get excited. She's not going back to her old career. A lot of people wish we could make her bartend again. We wish she would go back to bartending, where she could do a lot less damage than she's doing now. She's going back to bartending for a day to advocate for policies that led to one of her former employers shutting down its business. This is a leftist politician, a socialist, meddling where they ought not to be meddling. The freshman congresswoman, wow, what is up with my mouth today? It won't pronounce words. A pronunciation is hard. The freshman congresswoman will return to her district in New York City this Friday to pour a few pints and push for the federal Raise the Wage Act while showing support for abolishing below minimum wage for tipped workers in the state. This is according to the New York Daily News. The exact location of the event, which was organized by the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United, a New York-based nonprofit that advocates for increased pay through its One Fair Wage campaign, will be announced later. Saru Jayaraman, who's the co-founder of the Restaurant Opportunities Center United, said, "We're very grateful for our partnership with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who fully understands the struggles of these workers. As a former tipped worker, Representative Ocasio-Cortez can shed light on the importance of one fair wage to lift up these workers and their families." However, the very policies Ocasio-Cortez is set to draw attention to ultimately led to one of her former employers shutting down the business. Charles Millite, co-founder of the coffee shop where she previously worked, said that the increased minimum wage to $15 an hour for businesses with more than 11 employees led him and his partners to reevaluate their business and just shut things down. Quote, "I know it doesn't sound like much, $2 an hour, but when you multiply it by 40 hours by 130 people, it becomes a big number. And it was going to increase our monthly payroll $46,000. So this increasing to $15 an hour caused this one business a further expense monthly of $46,000. Multiply that by 12. That's how much it would cost them in a year. That's how much of their profits it would be eating into. That's, you know, it's not just profits. It's everything. It's business operating capital and everything. These people talking about a living wage, it's just nuts. Now, Ocasio-Cortez mourned the loss of the coffee shop and stopped by there before they closed up. She said, "The restaurant I used to work at is closing their doors. I swung by today to say hi one last time and kid around with friends like old times." She never acknowledged the policies that led to its demise, though. After being in business for 28 years and attracting big names, 130 employees ultimately lost their jobs when the company was driven out of business. Michael Saltzman, managing director of the Employment Policies Institute, says, "It's unfortunate that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would return to New York City to advocate for a policy that's caused so much harm to the people she used to work for. Rising labor costs coupled with no tip credit has already proven devastating in the Bay Area, and massive tipped wage increases put New York City's full-service restaurant job growth in the red." Did you catch that? In the red? It didn't just slow it down. It reversed it. "A national policy," he continues, "of this magnitude will only cause increased job layoffs and restaurant closures. New York City restaurants saw a nearly 2% job loss last year, the city's first loss in the sector in two decades. Nearly 77% of full-service restaurants have reduced employee hours. That's according to a survey conducted by the New York Hospitality Alliance on the wage increase. The survey also found that nearly a third of respondents plan to cut jobs and increase prices at their establishments. All businesses in the city must pay their employees the increased $15 per hour wage after December 31st of this year." The Hospitality Alliance says, "The results of this survey and other industry trends signal that a once growing industry responsible for hundreds of thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in economic impact has become stagnant." We've had stories before, you know, Hollywood stars have come out and tried to campaign on behalf of people who work in this particular service industry, and they work for a low base wage and tips. And if you know people who have been doing this for a little amount of time, and you may know someone who worked their way through college by waiting tables, and they'll tell you, if you hustle, if you're happy, if you treat people right, you make good money. Generally. If you don't, you don't make money because you're paid less than minimum wage. And it's your job to hustle and earn the rest. You're earning money. This is you being rewarded for doing a good job by the people who actually pay the bills, the customers. Now, my son, who lives in New Orleans, has been in the restaurant business for as long as he's lived there, since he got out of college. We, at one time, were visiting, and we sat down and talked about life, the universe, and everything. You know, because his mother and I are, you know, like, hey, you know, how long are you going to do this? And he told us how much he made. And I shut up. Because working in a little bitty diner in the tourist section in the French Quarter, working overnights from, you know, like 10 o'clock until 8 o'clock in the morning, that sort of a thing, working overnights, my son was making more than my wife and I combined. Why? Because he had fun at his job. He treated his customers nicely. He did a good job. And people appreciated his attention to them as he served them in that establishment. He hustled. He took care of them. He made sure the atmosphere there was right, which in that particular area involves throwing out the occasional drunk and abusive customer in order to make things better for everybody else. And as a result, he's raking in the money. Working overnights, waiting tables in a tiny diner in the French Quarter in New Orleans. Making more than his mother and I combined. If you do the job right, you can make a lot of money. But if that employer was required to pay him $15 an hour plus everybody else that works there, then the prices for their greasy hamburgers and hash browns would go up. And they wouldn't be able to staff as many people. And people wouldn't be as happy with the service. And they wouldn't be making as much money. And I think you see where the dominoes are falling. It would destroy that business, which is what happened to the business where AOC used to work. So it's best not to mess with something that works. But politicians who feel like they need to play the hero are all about messing up things that works, because it's more important that they look busy and important.
Mr. Personality starts now.
Oh. So I'm Mr. Personality now, am I? Okay, then. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective. Mark Congleton here, driving the crazy bus. Wow, there's so much crazy in the world today. I hope you've signed up for the newsletter. Go to dailyperspectivepodcast.com. That's the new website, dailyperspectivepodcast.com. Get signed up, and before you know it, you'll start receiving all of my notes, all of my links in your inbox. You get the show delivered directly to you, all the stories that I talk about in the morning, plus the ones I didn't have time to. I've just bumped a few off the list because I know I'm not going to make it. It's just not going to happen. So I've been trying to hustle through more stories. I don't know if you noticed yesterday, I was really hustling like crazy to get through more stories, and it just doesn't work out well. So I have to limit myself to 4 to 6 stories in the hour, and it gives us time to flesh things out, to talk about them, and explore the absurdity, and gain some insights, because that's what it's about. Observation, insight, and absurdity. And you get that delivered to your inbox every day. Go to dailyperspectivepodcast.com and get signed up today and start getting this all in your inbox. Speaking of absurdity, Netflix is talking about, they're considering boycotting filming in Georgia. And it's all because of the heartbeat bill that Georgia passed recently. And Netflix has decided to basically issue an ultimatum to the state of Georgia. If you don't repeal this law, we're not coming to film anything in your state anymore. And let's boil this down to what it really is. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I posted about it earlier on social media, and I don't want to rehash all that. But this is what this is Netflix, essentially a section of Hollywood trying to tell the rest of the country that their money is more important than the lives of people. Wrap your brain around that for just a moment. Netflix expects us to accept their premise that their production money being spent in the state of Georgia is of a higher value than human life. I'll just leave that right there. That's all I have to say about that. Because that is the perspective. That's the only perspective you can have on this if you are a realist. If you're an honest, rational, reasonable person. Honesty has to play into it. Remember, it's the production of fantasy entertainment versus human life. And they expect us to believe, they expect the state of Georgia to opt for their money over the lives of people. Unborn, innocent human life. That's what they expect us to choose. They expect the people of Georgia to choose money over people. That's what it boils down to. In a related story, yesterday, the president of Planned Parenthood, Liana Wen, issued a panicked tweet because if the state of Missouri doesn't renew Planned Parenthood's license for its clinic in St. Louis by Friday, Missouri will be the first state that doesn't have a single abortion clinic. That, I got to be honest with you, is incentive to move to Missouri. Because somebody there is thinking right. Here's what she tweeted. If Planned Parenthood's St. Louis Health Center cannot provide abortion care, this will be the first time since 1974 that safe, legal abortion care will be inaccessible to the people in an entire state. Wen also quavered that such occurrence would constitute a, quote, real public health crisis, and attacked the Trump administration, snapping, "This is the world that the Trump administration and anti-women's health politicians across the country have been pushing for, a world where abortion care is illegal and inaccessible in this country." She also said, "This is not a drill. This is not a warning. This is a real public health crisis. More than 1 million women of reproductive age in Missouri will no longer have access to a health center in their state that provides abortion care." Those two words bother me. Do they bother you? Abortion care? And I've heard enough and seen enough in video and in print from people who are former Planned Parenthood clinic workers whose their descriptions don't bring the word care to mind. Because what they seem to care about most is the bottom line. They sell abortion like a used car salesman sells cars. They're trained how to overcome objections. They are trained to sell abortion. And their clientele is coming there primarily for abortion. Yes, their supporters will tell you, "Oh, that's only 3% of what they do." Well, the dollar figures don't actually add up to that, but you be you. I don't think care and abortion go together in this context at all. But that's the fantasy they've created, so they'll stick with it. On May 24th, Missouri Governor Mike Parson signed HB 126 into law. He stated, quote, "By signing this bill today, we are sending a strong signal to the nation that in Missouri, we stand for life, protect women's health, and advocate for the unborn. All life has value and is worth protecting. Thanks to decades of pro-life leadership, Missouri recently hit an all-time low for the number of abortions. We've gone from a high of more than 20,000 in our state to now below 3,000. By working together, we can continue to assist more Missourians in choosing life." The bill states, quote, "Except in cases of medical emergency, no abortion shall knowingly be performed or induced upon a pregnant woman if the fetal heartbeat of the unborn child has been detected in accordance with the provisions of this section. The bill also states that the physician must determine whether the heartbeat of the unborn child can be detected, and if that is possible, the prospective mother must be given the option of hearing the heartbeat and be informed that unless there is an emergency, no abortion shall be performed. The bill adds that a physician will be punished if he or she does not conduct a fetal heartbeat detection test. And if an abortion is performed subsequent to the detection of a heartbeat, the physician will have his or her license revoked. Now, I just the other day watched a video of some folks on YouTube whose videos I follow on YouTube who are expecting a child. And they had that, what was it? I think it's the 12-week appointment where they got to listen to the baby's heartbeat. And they were both excited about the baby's heartbeat. This is a couple who had previously been told that they would not be able to have children, and now in their late 30s, they are suddenly expecting a child. And their whole world is changing. It's a child. It's their child, their baby. Honest people understand exactly what's going on here. That sex produces babies. That's the design. And that abortion ends the life of a baby, a human being, a person. And everyone who becomes pregnant, every mother, well, every woman who becomes pregnant is a mother. And when a mother destroys the life of her own child, that goes against the grain of everything that's wired into her, which is why you hear case after case after case after case of people, women who've had abortions, who light a candle on the day of that unborn child's birth, who will buy a flower arrangement on that day as a reminder, who will do little things. They may never tell anybody else what that means, but they do it anyway, because for the rest of their lives they remember and they know the truth. They're mothers, but they just don't have the children to show for it. Now, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court denies this fact. In a spat about fetal remains, the case that was brought before the Supreme Court, Box versus Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky, Supreme Court Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Clarence Thomas attacked one another's concurring and dissenting opinions. Yet Ginsburg's response must earn some prize for redefining the meaning of words. In a footnote, the liberal justice faulted her conservative colleague for using the term mother to describe women who choose abortion. Quote, a woman who exercises her constitutionally protected right to terminate a pregnancy is not a mother. She wrote this in an aside. This brief statement illustrates the divide between pro-life and pro-choice attitudes on abortion. Friendly atheist Hemant Mehta praised Ginsburg for that comment. Quote, this footnote from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is fire. She also says a footnote in Clarence Thomas's concurring statement displays more heat than light. And also along with that, tweeted a picture of the ruling, highlighting Ginsburg's not a mother declaration. Stop and think about that. That Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who serves as a justice on the Supreme Court of the United States, declared that a woman who exercises her constitutionally protected right to terminate a pregnancy is not a mother. This mentality, it says everything about the pro-abortion side. They have to deny reality in order to support their cause. When we have case after case, thousands upon thousands of women who acknowledge the day their unborn child would have been born had they not made that choice.
Now then, I'm going to do something I call the compliment sandwich, where I say something good, then talk about where you need improvement, and then end with something good.
Whatever you gotta do.
That was nice. Thanks. It is, excuse me, the Wednesday edition of the Daily Perspective. Mark Congleton here. And I just never cease to be amazed by the way the left thinks. How much obvious reality it has to ignore in order to justify its positions on things. And when Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually steps up and says that a woman pregnant who goes to an abortion clinic and aborts her child is not a mother, then you see clearly how deceived and delusional this mindset actually is. Because, well, okay, well, we're talking about the same kind of people who would say that they would say all these things about transgenders. I'm not going to go into the quotes. You just go look them up yourself, because they deny reality at every turn. And that's disturbing. It's just disturbing that we have people in our society. One, we have people in our society who actually choose to believe these things. And two, we have people in our government who actually deny reality and seek to make their denial of reality policy for the people of the United States. It's disturbing. We're seeing this trend happen not only in abortion, but also in our election process, because right now we're seeing state after state, 16 so far, I think, are voting to take the outcome of the what actually doesn't exist in this country, the popular vote. They want to take to tally up the individual votes of Americans state by state and then just award their votes in the Electoral College to whoever wins the most individual votes on a popular scale. They're calling it the National Popular Vote in an Interstate Compact, the NPV. And this is a disturbing trend. Now, at this point, none of the states which have signed on to this will make any difference, because those states all go left anyway. So what's happening is not really going to make any difference. But the fact that it's happening should bother us, because what these states, the governments, the politicians in these states, not the people, but the politicians in these states are deciding is that the votes of their people don't matter if they go against what they prefer to happen. So if you live in one of these states and you're a conservative and you vote conservative, and your state leans in a particular year conservative, and your electoral college votes go to the conservative candidate, then the people who are representing you at the state level are going to ignore what you have to say and vote the other way. So your vote means nothing. They're taking your power away from you. So what they are proposing to do is actually the opposite. They're living in loony land. Now, of all places in USA Today, which doesn't lean right, there's an opinion piece about this. And it says, should rural and small-town Americans be reduced to serfdom? The American founders didn't think so. This is one reason why they created checks and balances, including the Electoral College. Today, that system is threatened by a proposal called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, or NPV. Rural America produces almost all of our country's food, as well as raw materials like metals, cotton and timber. Energy, fossil fuels, but also alternatives like wind and solar come mostly from rural areas. In other words, the material inputs of modern life flow out of rural communities and into cities. This is fine, so long as the exchange is voluntary. Rural people choose to sell their goods and services, receive a fair price, and have their freedom protected under law. But history shows that city dwellers have a nasty habit of taking advantage of their country cousins. Greeks enslaved whole masses of rural people, known as helots. Medieval Europe had feudalism. The Russians had their serfs. Credit the American founders with setting up a system of limited government with lots of checks and balances. The U.S. Senate makes sure all states are represented equally, even low-population rural states like Wyoming and Vermont. Limits on federal power, along with the Bill of Rights, are supposed to protect Americans from overreaching federal regulations. And the Electoral College makes it impossible for one population-dense region of the country to control the presidency. This is why Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. Instead of winning over small-town Americans, she amassed a popular vote lead based on California and a few big cities. She won those places with huge margins, but lost just about everywhere else. And the system worked. The Electoral College requires more than just the most raw votes to win. It requires geographic balance. This helps to protect rural and small-town Americans. Now, a California millionaire named John Koza is trying to undo this system. He is leading and funding the National Popular Vote Campaign. Their plan is to get state governments to ignore how their own citizens vote in presidential elections and instead get them to cast their electoral votes based on the national popular vote. If it works, this will be like getting rid of the Electoral College, but without actually amending the Constitution. California has already passed NPV, along with 13 other states, plus Washington, D.C. Nevada, with 6 electoral votes, could be next. NPV only takes effect if it is joined by enough states that they control 270 electoral votes, which would then control the outcome of all future presidential elections. If that happens, NPV needs 81 more electoral votes to make that happen. And if the courts do not strike it down, big cities will gain more political power at the expense of everyone else. The idea that every vote should count equally is attractive, but a quote often attributed to Benjamin Franklin famously reminds us that democracy can be, quote, two wolves and a lamb voting for what's for lunch. City dwellers who think that meat comes from the grocery store might not understand why this is such a big problem for the lamb. And when do you think about it? Every check on government power, from the Electoral College to the Bill of Rights, is a restraint on the majority. The Electoral College makes it even harder to win the presidency. It requires geographic balance and helps protect Americans who might otherwise have their voices ignored. All Americans should have or should value constitutional protections like the Electoral College that remind us that the real purpose of government is to protect our individual rights. And I love this commentary because it goes right to the heart of things. And this is something I have said here, and that is that these dense population centers, these big cities, New York, LA, and the like, get everything they consume, for the most part, from the flyover states. Flyover country supplies the meat. They provide the grain. Flyover states provide the vegetables. Flyover states provide the metal. Flyover states provide the vast majority of what is consumed by these densely populated leftist areas. They don't understand that it's vitally important to give these areas as much protection as possible and as much right as possible in the bigger picture. In fact, the coastal elites, if I can use that term, look down their noses at flyover country. That's where the term came from. You fly over that country to get to where you really want to be. They look down their noses at the middle of the country, the places that produce everything they consume, as unenlightened, uninformed, ignorant, rubes, rednecks, hicks. And you see this reflected in social media. They're looking down on everybody else, thinking that we're not smart enough to understand how life really works. And that's actually ironic, because when you look at things, it's the people who live in these places and consume these goods who really don't understand how life works. You take them to a zoo, and they're amazed by what they see. And they insist that we need to protect all of these wonderful animals. And they're upset that these animals are in zoos. You take them to a farm. They're flabbergasted that their milk comes from that big thing with four legs. And that their hamburger does too. They're amazed when they see cornfields. They've had corn. They thought it came from the kitchen in the restaurant. They had no idea that somebody had to grow it. And you know what? I say that for the sake of absurdity, but it's not really all that absurd. Because I've seen people on YouTube online shocked and amazed by where things actually come from. Because they really have no clue. And these people think they know better than you and I about how things should be in our country. So, the Electoral College is protecting you and I from those who think they're better than us. It needs to be there. And we need to go. We'll see you tomorrow. God bless. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.